Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, and we are introducing a special off-season series of podcasts where we will talk to some folks in and around the sport of lacrosse who can bring a unique perspective to the game, everything surrounding the game, and have just kind of a general meandering conversation. And today, we welcome on our first guest, Taz, the official Taz Pete Sinercha. He is a CBS radio host, as well as a professional wrestling aficionado, analyst, former wrestler himself. Certainly somebody that I would imagine anybody who has come across the sport in any capacity is familiar with. And Pete, we really appreciate you joining us here today.
No problem, Terry. I appreciate it. My passion for lacrosse and stuff, and for lacrosse fans, and from the youth program all the way into the MLL, I'm a big fan besides being a lacrosse dad. So, yeah, I'm all in.
So let's start there. Let's lay the foundation with what your familiarity and entry point into the game was. You live on Long Island, you've raised a family there, and your son, Tyler, just finished up his senior year in high school at Plain Edge. He's heading to play in Bucknell, and, certainly an accomplished athlete, and we're going to dive into that. There's a lot to unpack as it relates to your experience as a lacrosse dad. But I'm interested, prior to Tyler picking up a stick for the first time, what was your familiarity with the sport?
Not much at all, to be honest with you. I mean, I grew up in the city. I grew up in Brooklyn and lived in Queens, and that's part of New York City, right outside of New York City. And Long Island, Nassau, Suffolk County, as many know, is the suburb. So I did not grow up on Long Island. My wife and I got married. We moved out to Long Island, wanted to start a family on Long Island. And I was not aware of the rich lacrosse tradition on Long Island, and I wasn't aware of the sport much at all, because growing up in the city, I played football in high school and college, but, in the city, when you grow up in a New York City school system, it's football, baseball, basketball, soccer. There was really no lacrosse. They ain't going to give you metal sticks to, swing around. and it really wasn't much amateur wrestling, believe it or not. So it was just those basic mainstream sports. So when we moved out here to the island, when Tyler was young, he was a multi-sport athlete. He played football for a long time. He wrestled. He was a very good wrestler. He was involved. I got him involved right away with grappling arts, like MMA. Just always wanted him to be able to take care of himself physically. And I have a mat in my house, so I always rolled around with him on a mat and taught him things as little as 2 years old. I mean, I just would always teach him how to stay off his back and how to step through if someone grabbed you, but just teach him how to defend himself, but not in aggressive form. And he took a liking to it as a little kid, and he got into wrestling, he got into grappling arts, and played football, when he was in fourth grade, and played all the way into middle school, and also played baseball. So he was playing baseball, and the town we live in, baseball is pretty good baseball programs and high school programs in our town. And once he was playing a lot of travel ball, playing up in age, and he was fifth grade playing with all sixth graders. He was on a really strong summer travel team. And we were playing actually at Cal Ripken's facility there in Aberdeen and in Maryland. And we were going into a big tournament. We're going into a big playoff or championship game. I can't remember what it was. We're leaving the hotel right there that was on the grounds there at Cal Ripken's facility. And he looks at me and my wife. He's like, I think I want to play lacrosse after baseball. And I'm like, what? Lacrosse? I had no idea. We never discussed that at my house. No one in my family ever played. Nothing. Like, how do you know about lacrosse? He goes, well, in school, in gym and recess, they have these lacrosse sticks. And, our gym teacher teaches us all how to play, the boys and girls. And then I realized the rich history of Long Island lacrosse. And the kids mess around when they're little in school and recess. And I'm like, well, let's go try and win this baseball playoff game first. Let's handle that first. And then we'll deal with this on a 4-hour ride home. And then he never looked back. He never played a baseball game, never touched a baseball bat again during fifth grade. He was done. And I knew nothing about it. So I had to find a legitimate coach, because I always believed that my son was going to play a sport that I had nothing to do with. I had no knowledge with. I always knew enough as a former athlete and a pro athlete that training and coaching is vital. So I made sure that I found the best lacrosse coach I could find just to teach him how to hold a stick and throw a ball and catch a ball, you know. And I got home and I went online. I started researching, and then I contacted an old friend of mine a long time ago. This was when Tyler was younger. I don't know if he even remembers, because he's got more concussions than me, and I'm talking about Mick Foley, right? So I called Mick, who his dad was the AD for many years at Ward Melville High School. And I knew that Mick's dad knew a lot of lacrosse people, and I think Mick knew some people. And he kind of gave me some different names of people I had to look into. And I fell upon a guy named Mike Chanichuk, Sr., who, as many know, is the dad of Mike Chanichuk, Jr., who had the big success at Maryland and plays for the Charlotte Hounds now, and is a great midfielder and all this jazz. So, and Mike Chanichuk Sr., met Tyler when he was a fifth grader and just started training him. And once or twice a week, just teach him how to catch and throw and taught him how to, get ground balls. And Tyler always knew he wanted to play with a pole. He wanted to play defense. He just knew enough about the game, and he saw it on MLL on TV, and he knew he wanted to be a defenseman. And Chanichuk would not let him touch a long pole. He said, no, you're going to learn to play lacrosse with your feet first. You'll play defense with your feet, and then you'll earn the right to use a pole. And that's, old school, I guess, but that's how it all started. And then he just rolled from there.
So what was your first impression of the first game that you saw? Were you just like, this is chaos, I don't understand what's going on? Or were you like, this is awesome, I really wish I had had this when I was younger, and I would have dove in head first?
Part two, the second part, I wish that I would have had it growing up. I knew right away, once I watched stuff online, I'm like, wow, this is really some sport that is just, it's just a hybrid of so many different things, from hand-eye coordination, from physicality, from speed, from quickness, to an IQ. It covered every base. And I think a lot of that helped, humbly speaking, my son become a pretty good player quick, because he always had a tremendous hand-eye coordination from being a good young youth, baseball player. And he had toughness because, he was involved with, a collision sport like football and all that jazz. And, he just kind of, he caught on to the game right away. And I made sure that my wife and I always wanted him to be around, like I said, not to be redundant, around good coaching at that age. And he did. I mean, he learned under guys, no lie, within a span of about a year and a half, maybe a year. And I'll just drop some names if that's cool. Guys like I said, Mike Chanichuk Sr., guys like Nicky Polanco, guys like Brian Spolina, guys like Jim Ulay. I mean, these were the guys he was learning from all the time. So he rapidly grabbed the game. And being here on the island, you have access to a lot of those folks, and it obviously worked out for him.
And so, as you kind of dive in to being a lacrosse dad, obviously supporting Tyler is a huge part of your entry point into the game. You mentioned the connection through Mick Foley, which I'm sure is so fascinating to any lacrosse wrestling hybrid fan. What an inroad, right? But then,
what it was, Terry, the thing with Mick, that conversation, it might have been a text. That was like a 2-second thing. Like, he just dropped a name. Like Mick, I don't even know if Mick remembers. I've seen Mick several times after that. We never even talked about it. But now I'm talking to you doing this podcast with you, and I'm like, I got to get a hold of Mick to see if he remembers this, because it was crazy. It was so quick. Taz, check this guy out. That type thing. And it was that quick, but I digress. Continue, sorry.
Yeah, well, that's awesome. I mean, that's what I'm saying. It's a great story. But so the next part is, Long Island is an interesting place. And so for a city kid to move out to the suburbs and all that entails, like I said, raising a family out there, and you realize that lacrosse is ingrained in the culture in a way that I think, you look at the rest of the New York metro area and it surrounds Manhattan, right? Southern Connecticut,
yep.
Westchester County, North Jersey. Like, these are hotbeds for lacrosse. And yet, all these people that grow up in the boroughs and probably have no idea of what's going on. So, Long Island is a unique and interesting place. And certainly the experience of being a part of that community, I would imagine the number of stories you pull away from that. I've always said that, the Real Housewives of Orange County or whatever has nothing on the real lacrosse families of, Long Island, Baltimore, wherever. And I got to get your
agree.
Sense of what that was like. What do you take away from that experience?
It was hell. It was straight up hell. it was, I mean, I'm from the wrestling business where it, and I'm going to be blunt here, okay? I wear my emotions on my sleeve. I don't pull a lot of punches. That's my deal, right? So I'm just being frank. You know, it was not easy. I'm just going to say it as it is. The politics, the inside games, all this kind of stuff was, I saw it right away. I witnessed it right away, and I saw that it could get a little dirty behind the scenes. I saw it right away because it is a hotbed, and because there's so many great players, young players that are here, and I saw it right away, and I saw the positioning of different club owners and all this. I could spot it from a while, and it's going to sound crazy, it has nothing to do with lacrosse, but truly, being from the wrestling industry all the years I've been in the wrestling business for 30 years, and I, as you can imagine, I've seen a lot of, you know, shifty, sketchy promoters in my day. And I also, being a New York City kid, I'm kind of a street smart guy. And I could tell right away, I could see some of the stuff from a mile away. I'm like, all right, this guy's cool. That guy's cool. That guy, not so much. But, you know, I could see the forest as others were looking at the trees type deal. You know, not to use that cliche, but that's truly how I saw it. And I tried to help my son the best I could navigate that. At the end of the day, I always told him, and my wife always said, it don't matter. All that other noise that's going on with politics or this, that, the other thing, at the end of the day, when the whistle blows, you got to play your butt off, and you got to make sure you're training. You got to make sure you're out playing everyone every practice, every game. And that was ingrained in his brain right away. And he knew that from being a youth athlete in other sports. Now, the Long Island thing, and you're right about the Orange County Moms, all the whatever, all that stuff, all those reality TV shows. Oh, God. Dude, I swear, I know enough people in like TV production. I should have done that, where I had a camera crew follow, you know, me just seeing some of the stuff. Like, it was, it's definitely a lot of drama. There's definitely a lot of different shifting and moving and, you know,
alliances,
absolutely. A lot of backstabbing, a lot of alliances. You got to really be careful, this, that, and the other thing. Once your kid gets as an upperclassman in high school, it kind of like disappears, to be frank. But, it was disappointing, but I'm a creature of habit. Okay, I'm from that world, and I raised my kid that way. You know, look, if we're going to play nice, we're going to play nice. But if we're going to play dirty, let's knuckle up and play dirty. You know, I mean, that's just me, you know, and I think my kid is similar. Maybe not as bad as me, but he's similar. And the thing is, like, I knew that a lot of that stuff, that Long Island stuff with some parents, and to be frank, it was mostly dads, not moms, to be honest. It was coming from a place of passion. And that's going to sound weird because I'm complimenting that, but to stereotype all these people, I have to say, a lot of it does come from trying to either be the best dad or mom they could be. And because they're passionate, and because it's a very competitive, insanely competitive world here with lacrosse, because it's Nassau and or Suffolk County. And at the end of the day, it comes from a place of passion or from a place of someone trying to live vicariously through their kid. So that's just, you know, that happens in anything, you know, in any sport when you have kids playing a sport, boy or girl, you know. So, look, you know, it is what it is. And you know, it wasn't like, oh, my God, this is horrible. I got to move my kid out of Long Island, play lacrosse somewhere else. Because if you're playing in a hotbed area, you're going to have it. I'm sure there's some of that same stuff in Maryland, probably up in Connecticut a little bit too, maybe in Jersey a little bit. I think the Long Island lacrosse dads, I think we have the worst stigma, though, I would say. Wouldn't you think?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's definitely a little bit of that follows you around. I mean, you know, the percentage of New York license plates that are in a recruiting event parking lot is probably going to correlate pretty strongly with whether or not there's an incident on the sideline. But yeah, I mean, at the risk of getting a little bit too negative too early in the podcast, let's pull back the lens a little bit. And I know, you know, one of the things that I'm really curious about is, you know, for a dad
does that mean we're going to get more negative later?
Oh, 100%.
You kind of just said that.
100%. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we're going to bring this all the way back around like a boomerang. But what I'm saying is, so, you know, I'm really interested in your perspective. You know, as you were a professional athlete whose arc and trajectory of development in terms of your athleticism was probably really unique. And I think that's probably true for most professional athletes, because you grow up playing sports that are not the sport that you go pro in. And so through that, I would imagine, you focus more so even than a lot of NBA, NFL, Major League Baseball players on what that development is like for your body. And I say that to ask this. What was it like watching Tyler develop as an athlete? What lessons did you learn through your own experience that you tried to subtly or directly, you know, help inform his development as an athlete, as a player, you know, everything that kind of falls there within?
First of all, it's a great questions on your part with this deal here. As a dad, watching Tyler's development all these years was unbelievable, like amazing, an amazing experience for me and my wife. For me as an athlete, I have to tell you, this is not me, blowing smoke up my kid, you know, but he's 10 times the athlete I was. I mean, when I was his age, 10 times. And I'm not kidding you. And a lot of that is, I mean, he's got some good genetics in our family, and that's number one. Number two, you know, he was fortunate enough to get the proper training at a young age, not just the cross. I'm talking about speed training. I'm talking about working on his foot speed, working on first step explosion, working on his agility. And he always had a very powerful work ethic since he was a little kid. And I noticed that right away, and I pushed him a little bit. I wasn't like, I know a lot of people would Google me and see me as an athlete or as a pro wrestler and think, oh, this guy must have been crazy torturing this kid. No, I was not. As much as I look like that guy, I'm not. You know, I would say, look, you're going to play a sport. You never quit. You have to complete the season. I don't care what sport it is. When you're young, you play all the way through. There's no quitting. That's not allowed in the house, not out. And, you know, you have to make sure you want to do this. That's number two. And you're going to work. You got to train. Yeah, Dad, I got it. I'm in. And he always did. He just always trained. And that's the key. Training is the key. I learned that as a pro wrestler. Now, someone said, well, pro wrestler, that stuff's all fake. Okay, well, you could think that and be narrow-minded. But what folks don't realize is that what we, and I know we'll get into the wrestling in a little bit, but as a pro wrestler, you know, we're kind of a hybrid of a stuntman, an actor, and an athlete, and we have no off season. So the key thing to keep your body healthy, because you have to get paid, because if you're not healthy as a wrestler, you're not making money, because we're all independent contractors. So this is not like you got a big contract like LeBron James. It's a totally different world. Yeah, you can make a lot of money, but you got to be healthy. So how do you stay healthy? By staying flexible, by staying strong, by staying in shape, by eating properly, proper nutrition, proper rest, resting your body. And all of these things, I humbly say, I always gave to Tyler and taught him that at a young age, probably as early as, you know, 8, 9 years old, not lifting weights, but about training and working. And, you know, hey, you want to play baseball? Great. You're going to live on a tee. You're going to hit the ball off the tee. You're going to train. We're going to do soft toss all the time. We're going to do this, that. You know, you're going to work your butt off. You want to play football? Okay, good. We're going to work on hitting the slab. We're going to work on coming out of a 3-point stance. We're going to work on tackling dummies. We're going to work. Yeah, I'm in. I'm in, Dad. I'm in. And he always was that kid that always wanted to work and train. And he's still that way now. And the beauty is, I don't have to do nothing. He's on autopilot. So he just, you know, he gets his car and he goes, trains 4 or 5 days a week. He eats properly. And he still has all, and thank God, as he's going to play Division I lacrosse, he needs that, obviously. But he always had that training work ethic thing to outwork everyone if he can. And just push, and that's the key, training and outworking people. And so far, so good with this kid. So,
well, you mentioned, and I mentioned at the top, he's heading to Bucknell. I'm interested in your perspective on the recruiting process. I mean, you know, there's very little dispute that the early recruiting is pretty crazy, and a lot of folks decry it as applying too much pressure to a family or to a young man. And you know, obviously, having gone through it, I would imagine that you got some thoughts on it.
I got a lot of thoughts on early recruiting. Look, I can't sit here and knock it. I know the rules change now, which I think is good, but I can't knock it. My son was one of those kids that, you know, that type of kid that so many people talked about. The kid that when he was 14 years old committed, and he did commit, and he has zero regrets on that commitment, as do my wife and I. Because I think, and this is the thing on this early committing thing and stuff like that, I got to tell you, for folks that knock the early recruiting for those of us that had their kids, boys or girls, commit as freshmen. You know, you got to understand something. I hate to stereotype, but I would think the bulk of those people that had a lot of negative things to say, no matter if they're a coach, if they're a columnist, if they're a reporter, if they're a mom or dad, whatever, 9.5 out of 10 times, those are the people that their kids either weren't recruited young, or weren't getting into looks, or maybe they don't have kids. So it's easy to judge people and families from afar. I really believe with the early recruiting, every kid is different. Every kid depends on the maturity level of the kid first and foremost. Forget lacrosse, forget physicality. I think from a maturity perspective, the way he can carry a conversation with an adult in a room is an important thing. Now, my son is an only child. So, you know, at 14, as he was a freshman at the time at St. Anthony's, you know, he was very advanced mentally, maturity-wise, because he was around adults a lot and he had no younger siblings or older siblings. So I think that's the first thing that was an advantage for him, his maturity, okay? The other thing was, you know, he played at, you know, many big events as an eighth grader, going into the ninth grade, big recruiting events, like a lot of these boys did. And you know, the sidelines flooded with coaches. And, you know, a lot of them that stood out or made all-star teams and did this or played well or who got 5 goals or who got, you know, 10, you know, 7 ground balls, whatever, who had 3 cause turnovers, whatever it is. And then you get a call from a D1 coach, you know, through your club coach or through your high school coach before your kid even plays varsity. And you get an opportunity to potentially get – it's like musical chairs. So the music stops, and they offer you a chair. And what do? You know, if it's a school that's a great academic institution, it's a school that has a good lacrosse program or strong lacrosse program, it's a place that your kid wants to go because he visited or he feels he wants to do this. So the music stops, they offer you a chair, and you say to that place with all those things, you know what? I'll wait for the next song. When the music stops, I'll take my chances. Okay. That's the thing. You know, so I think that everybody's different. I think that every kid's different. I think every opportunity is different when it comes to early recruiting. And, you know, for him, you know, he was recruited by several schools. It wasn't just one school. So, you know, he visited schools early, and it's something that he wanted to do. And you could imagine, as parents, my wife and I, you know, had a plethora of conversations with him during that time, you know, each place we went and visited and each phone call we got from a club coach or a high school coach saying, hey, you know, blah, 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 because no one's breaking rules. You know, you can't do that. So every time that happened, you know, it's a conversation with our kid. Like, you know, look, you're young. It's a verbal commit. You know, it's a nerve-wracking thing. But I looked at it. Now it's kind of past tense stuff, right, because the rule changed. But I look at it as, if your kid goes to visit not once or twice or 3 times or whatever, and it's an excellent school academically, and you have a kid who is a good student at 14, who is showing the ability to be a strong athlete playing against some of the better kids. I'm not just talking about Tyler. I'm talking about a lot of the kids, his contemporaries, his age that he's mixed it up with. I've seen it with my own eyes. I've seen these kids, you know, that a lot of them that have a lot of attention on them now going to college, no matter if they're ranked or not, no matter what people believe in rankings or matter all this other stuff. And most of these kids are as advertised. I'm just telling you, I've seen them with my own eyes at these events, you know, how good most of them are. And I've seen them be good at 14 up to now, because once he committed to Bucknell, you know, it was heavy. It was wild. You know, it was cool. But you got to say, too, one more thing. With Bucknell, you know, he had been to, since I want to say 7th grade, several of their camps that they held in the summer. So he stayed on campus with a bunch of other kids. And, you know, he knew, I don't want to say he knew the camps like the back of his hand. He was a young kid, but he had been to several camps before he was a freshman in high school. So I guess they kind of knew him, and he knew them and the program, and that made it a little bit easier. You know what I mean? So because they saw him develop over a couple of years, I guess. You know, but the thing is, if it's, just to get back to my point, if it's a program that's a very good lacrosse program or a great lacrosse program, and it's a university that academically is very strong, and you have a kid who is a very good student, you know, who works hard in the classroom, who trains, who's a good player, and the music stops and they offer you a chair. So you're going to throw a flag on a mom that allows their freshman to commit, or a dad that allows their freshman kid, or a kid that commits that early? I mean, I think every kid's different. I really do. And I think every situation's different. I mean, I just want to say one thing. So like the group of kids on Long Island that had a lot of attention on them when the kids were young, I mean, a bunch of these kids committed, you know, and maybe one or two changed their commitment over the course of 3-4 years, because you got to keep playing. You still get recruited. You know, you're not signing your letter of intent until you're a senior. So, you know, so my point is a lot of those kids kept their commitments.
I appreciate you providing that perspective, because I agree with almost everything you said. Restate something that I've said many times before, my stance on early recruiting for the majority of my tenure at Inside Lacrosse was very laissez-faire. Let the market dictate what's best for the school, the athletic department, the men's lacrosse program, and then the families themselves, right? And so,
right.
You know, the idea of like kind of a protectionism or a restriction to protect these folks from themselves, you know, that's just kind of contrary to the culture that we live in. But I want to build on that in two ways. The first is, your point is well taken. I've always used the what's the worst that could happen. So, like, you commit to Carolina, Virginia, Hopkins, or in your case, Bucknell, and it doesn't work out. The lacrosse situation isn't as optimal as you would like.
Right.
The worst thing that happens is you get a degree from an elite institution. Like, that's a great thing. You know what I mean? You know how many high school seniors going through the admissions process would kill to be in that position?
Amen. Totally agree. I mean, from an academic standpoint, I mean, look, what's the end game with lacrosse? I mean, yeah, sure, you can go to the MLL. I mean, you're not going to become a multimillionaire in the MLL, unfortunately. I mean, I think those men are drastically underpaid. But you know, I mean, the end game is to try and get a good career outside after lacrosse in college. And that comes with having a good degree from a good university. You know, so lacrosse can help that.
And a great network, and lacrosse helps that as well. And the other point that you made that I think is essential is the idea of how effective it is. And so, because there's a correlation in some people's minds between the most blatant early recruiters and their diminishing success, that this is a cause and effect relationship. You know, I would dispute that, but even before getting to that particular point, you know, I've long been a believer in how easy it is to identify talent early. I have this example. Like, on my high school football team, there was one player in our class who went to the NFL. And if you had asked me on the first day of practice, freshman year of high school, which player was going to go to the NFL, every single one of my teammates would have said, that kid, you know? And Anthony Gonzalez went on to become a great receiver at Ohio State and a first-round draft pick to the Indianapolis Colts. And every single one of my teammates would have said, he's the best player on our team. Yeah. We were not professional recruiters or professional NFL scouts, but it was not very difficult to identify who the best athlete on our team was. And yes, it gets to a point when you get to the 100th commit in a class and you're not finished with the freshman summer that maybe, you know, there's going to be some mistakes, but that's always going to be the case. That is as true at the end of your junior summer. Again, the variance might be a little bit wider early on, but like, you know, more and more, I think that that is an overblown point. Now, I just want to put a bow on this topic by saying, when it came time to talk about the recruiting legislation proposal, it was before the NCAA, I advocated for it for one reason. I thought it was a good idea for one reason. It is because I do believe that more kids are quitting lacrosse as eighth graders and freshmen in high school than ever before because of the perception that their opportunity has already escaped them. And I think that
I agree with that.
Negating that perception is a really healthy thing for the sport. But the reason that this proposal can and potentially should work is because it's just going to be a level playing field for everyone. And it's not going to unduly impact anyone negatively. So, like, the idea is...
And you know this, Terry, you know, there's tons of great late bloomers all the time.
And those kids, so right, yeah, I mean, I guess that's always been the most kind of spirited, like, emotional argument against early recruiting. The idea is that the late bloomers don't get the shot they deserve based on their late blooming.
Right.
And that's true to a degree, If you're beyond a certain threshold and you're a late bloomer, somebody's going to find you. Somebody's going to find a solution to get you on their team. It's like if you fall in that 75th percentile to the 50th percentile and normally you would have ended up, you know, you might end up being a D2 or D3 All-American, whereas previously you would have been a starter at a top 30 Division I program. And it's that kid that's going to benefit the most from this legislation. And there are going to be kids who end up being bench players at top 30 programs that never get on the field who – I guess are the victims, the anti-beneficiaries of this. And that's okay. You know what I mean? Like, those kids are going to end up being starters at D2 and D3 programs. And so, you know, to a degree, it's always going to be a little bit of a shell game. I don't think that the top-end players are going to end up at significantly different programs than they otherwise would have in the previous timeline.
Right. Well, that's why, and I agree with what you just said, and that's why when you first brought this up to me a few minutes ago, when I gave you that very long-winded answer, on my part, I'm saying, I said I'm in favor of the new rule, and because I remember seeing, you know, when a lot of kids committed as freshmen, and my kid was actually cool about it. A lot of kids felt very pressured, you know, academically. Kids felt very pressured athletically. The spotlight was always on them. Then there were the kids. I knew kids, dads of kids, I should say, here on the island that did not commit as freshmen, and they were panicking And those of us that had kids that did commit as freshmen, like, there's always, don't panic, there's time, relax. And so this new deal here will kill all that. And one more thing real quick. So a few weeks ago on my son's, you know, varsity team, well, they're done now, but a freshman who's a very good player, he's an attacker, he's really good. He's a young guy. Okay, he's only playing lacrosse for about a year and a half. But this kid just, you know, he's talented. And his dad's like, I heard about this new rule. I'm so happy because my son needs a couple of years to really learn the game and develop because he's only playing for like a year and a half. And I said, dude, this rule is great for a guy like you and a kid like yours. And it is. You know, it's great for guys like that.
And I think everybody knows that. And, I think now the only – there's, you know – that. I think the implementation of this rule, and I didn't want this conversation to be exclusively about this, but I do think you're an interesting person to talk to because of, as again, as said multiple times, the multitude of perspectives. But, you know, I think this is going to be a multi-phase implementation. Right now, the biggest issue is kids who have committed not being able to talk to their coaches, right? They're going to age into being able to talk to their coaches, and that'll be fine. I think we're entering the second phase with, you know, the start of the summertime where new evaluations are going to start coming in from coaches who want to contact or express interest to a kid. I think that's going to be the second phase. You know, someone that they've never spoken to, how are they going to communicate interest to that individual? And then the third phase is once you get to, you know, the 2022 class year where it is completely no one has been evaluated, nobody has spoken to a kid in that class, presumably, you know, with some very, very limited exceptions. Then what happens with the commitments? When is the first commitment in that class? How does it happen? How exposed is it? If
the
it is,
phones will be ringing at midnight.
September at midnight 1st, on September 1st, right? or will the phones not be ringing because the back channeling has allowed 150 kids to already nominally commit? And when the phone rings on midnight, it's just the first time where the coach can talk to the player and say, "We're good, right? Yes. All right, hang up. Boom. On to the next one." And like that's the thing that we don't know. You know what I mean? I'm not sure. You're
right.
How would you if Tyler were a 2022? Would you have let him commit to a program without ever having spoken to the coach when he was, say, a freshman or a sophomore?
Never. Never, ever, never, never, never. No, sir. Nope. No way. I would not suggest that for any parent.
And how distrustworthy would you be of a coach, or distrusting would you be of a coach who accepted the commitment of a kid he had never spoken to?
I think that's insane. I think that's crazy. I could not respect, as a man, man to man, towards another coach. I couldn't respect how could you? If you listen, a big part of being successful in sports is attitude, is your temperament, is your demeanor. You can't do that by watching a highlight reel of a kid and seeing what he's like. You can't do that. You need to have a conversation. You need to look in this kid's eyes, see if he's saying the right stuff, see if he's sincere, the best to your knowledge, and get to know him a little bit. I think that's important. And I do think, in defense to a lot of the early commits, I do think that was happening a little bit, where there was, you know, there was different conversations. You know, now with this new thing, to your point, we just said, oh, that's a little funky, man. I would never, if my kid was a 2022, I could never, ever let him commit somewhere until he's, I, forget about me. My wife would be throwing flags left and right. Like, no way, he's not committed.
No, and I think that's why it's gonna. That's why I think it's gonna be effective. There are some people who believe that, you know, this is essentially more symbolic than it is practical, and I'm not one of them. I think that, you know, two things are gonna happen. The first is, you know, kind of that tangible implementation of the third phase, right? The second thing is, if somebody gets in trouble, depending on how big the punishment is. And it might not actually even need to be that big, because the point that I've always made is when you have coaches win national championships, walk into their athletic director's office, their boss's office, and they hear, thanks, great, nice job. Make sure that your GPA goes up next year and you don't get in trouble. And, like, that is the way that they're regarded on campus. The competitive balance versus the keeping your nose clean is so important that for a lot of these guys, for a lot of these Division I men's head coaches, it's not worth it to risk a recruiting violation, even if the punishment isn't that severe, because the non-punishment could be very severe. And I think it's going to have some. I think it's going to have some teeth. And even if it doesn't, even if all of these commitments happen, they're just quiet, I still think it's going to accomplish a goal that was the reason that I advocated for it in the first place, which is the perception that the opportunity still exists.
And the one thing, I know you know this, but maybe there are some parents that are listening to this, that of younger kids, like when they hear about these early commitments, like when from my son's class and a couple of classes after his, I just want to say this though, like, you know, the key was once these players committed early back in the day, it seems like ages ago, right? 4 years ago. The key was, you had to keep playing. You had to keep evolving your game against high-level competition. And I think that's, you know, that's important. That was important, again, past tense. I think that was important. And I just think that we'll probably never see this early committing thing ever again because it's done now. But I have to say, a lot of the kids, a lot of the kids that I saw on Long Island at these events, they were always playing as freshmen, then sophomore, then juniors. You know, they were always trying, most of them, not all, but most of them were constantly pressuring themselves to got to keep playing at a high level. So my point in saying that, Terry, is I think about the younger dad or mom that might be hearing us that has a kid that's in fourth grade that thinks the kid's going to be a really good lacrosse player, which hopefully that kid is, thinking, wow, these kids just committed as freshmen in high school, and it's like, all right, you're done now. No, it just began. Once my son committed as a freshman, dude, it just began. I mean, that's when that's when academically there's a gun to your head. I mean, in my house, I'm not talking about coaches. I'm talking about that's when athletically you got to really push yourself because you got to stay at that level or higher, you know? So I think that many people kept that pressure, or those kids kept that pressure on themselves, and the parents kept that pressure on the kid. That's something I think that a lot of people haven't really talked about, and maybe not enough parents have a platform to say things like this.
Yeah, and I think that's an important part of the conversation too. But, you know, I want to transition a little bit because I know, you know, when you and I were preparing for this, there were a couple other topics in this realm that you wanted to touch on. We're getting closer to the opportunity to steer negative if you so desire, and I know that the New Yorker in you is really chomping at the bit for that. But before we jump there, I want to give you an opportunity to shout out, some of the folks that you think are doing it right, you know. And so you mentioned obviously that Tyler started his high school career at St. Anthony's. He finished his high school career playing for Plain Edge High School. I know that he's been a part of some of the most high profile summertime events and off season events as a player as well. Maverick Showtime, Project 9, some of the other events like that. He played in the IL Epic Committed Academy last summer. I'm just interested in what your perspective is, you know, from both yours and from Tyler's, in terms of, you know, is there anybody that you want to shout out that you think is doing it right, or that Tyler got a lot out of?
You mean as far as coaches doing it right? I'm a little confused what you mean.
Like, no, I mean, all across the board, whether it was an event that you attended or a coach that you had an interaction with or whatever else.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Yeah, all right. Well, a couple things. I got to think now. He's been a part of, humbly saying, a lot of really good events. When he was a little bit younger, like as a sophomore and or junior, like I got to tell you, like last year, as far as like that Under Armour underclass, I can't speak for these other regions, but I could tell you on Long Island, that tried. He made the team. He played hard and did well, thank God. But he made the team last year. I'm saying that tryout for that thing now, it, the top 40, whatever it was. It was, that was probably the most high intense, different, whatever words or adjectives you want to put on it, tryout I've ever witnessed with high school lacrosse players. It was super intense. And I don't know how those coaches pick, because there's some kids that, you know, that you say, wow, why didn't that kid make the team? That, you know, it was hard. I mean, there was a lot of good talent there. And that was probably the best tryout event I've ever seen. When he was a little bit younger, Maverick Showtime, he'd been invited to Maverick twice. He made the All-Star team as a junior, but not as a sophomore. I thought that that Maverick All-Star event was insane. The All-Star game was great. Not blown smoke, man, but you guys last year, one of his most favorite events, and my wife and I were at the event, the IL Committed Academy. To me, it's just such a smart event that you guys came up with there, taking players that are all recruits and committed and have them play as conferences against other conferences. So now your teammates are essentially your opponents in conference when you're in college. Very cool concept. And he had a blast at that. And again, talk about high level lacrosse, elite level high school, upperclassmen lacrosse. And that's what that committed games was that you guys did. So I got to say, the Under Armour event, the Under Armour underclass event, I thought it was done okay when we came down there to Maryland. I can't remember. Was that a Towson or Goucher? Where was
yeah,
that?
Yeah, that was a Towson. Yep, that's a Towson.
Towson, yeah, yeah. Okay, the Inside of the Course Committee was at Goucher. So,
yes, that's right.
So, yeah, the event at Towson was it was okay. You know, it was a lot of good teams. They kept it rolling good. But that tryout here on the island was insane, I got to tell you. It was wild. It was a tough tryout. I think that back in the day, like when he was a freshman, the best event he was at, and I think what really kind of, humbly speaking, put him on the map, and him and a lot of kids, not just him, was the Philly Showcase. I don't know if they still do that, but that was a very good event in Philadelphia. Now, that brings you to my point. Okay, so I kind of added the recruiting process. I don't know much about it now because of this new rule and all that stuff, and I'm not on top of a lot of the events. But this is something I want to say here. So, you know, you hear so much in the lacrosse community and even from college coaches, some coaches, and they you hear it from TV announcers and everything, you know, people just drilling parents on TV and players, multi-sport athlete. But, you know, football, nonstop. I played high school football. I played college football. I coached high school football at a really good program here on the island years ago. I love football. I love football more than I love lacrosse, okay? But as a fan and as a former player and a former coach, but I can tell you this. Again, I don't know how it is now, but, you know, for a kid who's a 2017 or 2018 or 2016 or 2015 player, you know, a few years ago, if you wanted to get recruited, you had to be playing lacrosse at a high-level event in the fall. So that's the first thing. How are you going to go and play on your high school football team when you got to be at a fall event? So it's like, well, put the stick down. Yeah, you got to put the stick down. You put the stick down in August and summer, September, then you got to pick the stick back up. The better players play all year round. They train all year round. So the football, that whole thing is kind of like, go play football. Okay, yeah. And then, you know, you run a risk of maybe not getting recruited in the fall. Some of these players wanted to be recruited in the fall. That's number one. More importantly, on my point on the multi-sport thing, it's not even the recruiting thing. It's I think a little of that, just as an athlete, is a little bit exaggerated. I have to be frank. And I don't think anyone's said this publicly, so I don't want to piss anyone off, but I'm just being honest, you know.
Open it up, baby.
If anybody out there has a little kid, a little boy or a girl that's playing lacrosse, and you're panicking and think that your kid has to play two sports, three sports, I would highly suggest, yes, when your kid's little in grade school and even going into middle school, let him play as many sports as he or she wants to play. That's the important time. That's what my kid did, and he did that for a reason. We kind of pushed him a little bit that way, but to see, first of all, what he likes to play and what he's going to morph to, what sport will he lean to, if any. He might say, I'm done with sports. Once I'm a freshman in high school, I'm done. I don't want to play sports anymore. That could happen too. And whatever that is, that's fine. Whatever. It's your kid, you love them, and whatever it is. But the thing is this. You let them play as many sports as possible when they're little, in my opinion, because that's when the motor skills are really developed, when you're little. you know, once your kid gets to that 13-year-old age, you know, a little bit, you know, 13, some kids 12, maybe early 14s, your motor skills are just about there. You know, I mean, so it's like if a kid's playing two sports in high school, that's great. God bless him. To each his own. Awesome. If he can do it and he can handle it academically and he can physically handle it, that's great. Play three sports. But I don't think that for lacrosse players to succeed, it's the end all be all as high school players, because your motor skills are kind of intact already. You know, I think it's more important to train, lift, work on your flexibility, work on your nutrition. I think those are more important than just to, I've seen it. I've seen it here with some kids that are, you know, excellent, awesome lacrosse players, and some that are in college now, that are freshmen in college, that are from here on the island, that didn't play two sports in high school, and they're doing pretty good. So, I mean,
yeah,
most of them played a lot of sports when they were little, you know? So I just, that's my only thing. It's a motor skill thing. It's about, you know, I just think it's a little bit exaggerated that you have to play two sports in high school or three sports. I don't think you have to do that. I really don't.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, a couple things about that. I mean, I think that, you know, first and foremost, my opinion of the folks who really advocate for that are doing so from the perspective of romanticizing their own experience. And so, you know, it's not like there's anything wrong with that. I mean, I look at it from my own experience. I played football and lacrosse in high school. I played for an incredibly successful football program, and I took a lot of really positive lessons. My junior and senior year high school lacrosse experiences were pretty bad, and I took a lot of negative lessons from them. Stuff to avoid. Things about how to,
Were you a better football player or were you a better lacrosse player?
I mean, I was a below average both. You know what I mean? I was an athlete that had to focus on a specialty because I didn't have the well diversified athletic profile that you're talking about, right? Like I wasn't fast. I wasn't incredibly I didn't have the it, right? Like I didn't have the ability to like create plays, whether it was in basketball or in lacrosse or whatever. So I was a goalie in lacrosse because I was tough enough and willing enough to stand in front of the ball. And I was a center in football because I was tough enough to pick up blitzing middle linebackers. You know what I mean?
You like getting hit with stuff.
Exactly. But that was for me why it was valuable. You know, I didn't think that one – I actually thought that doing both made me worse at the other, because I needed to be as light as possible to be a good goalie, and I needed to be as heavy as possible to be a good center, and I just ended up being in the middle the whole time. So, like, I actually thought that it artificially kept my ceiling low. But I do think, like I said, being a part of two different teams, playing for two different types of coaches, that provided a lot of, like, long-term value, the lessons of which I'm still utilizing. But I don't think that that's a very modern perspective for two reasons. The first is, you know, I went to a big Jesuit high school. And so, you know, sports at my school were different from sports at, like, a lot of, like, public high schools, for example. And the opportunities were greater. You know, I remember talking to Jamie Monroe about this like 5 years ago, and he was saying, if you think it's realistic for a kid to play multiple sports at a big public high school in most of the United States, like either this kid is like a professional athlete level, or you just have a misinterpretation of what the ecosystem is right now in terms of how competitive it is.
Yeah, and a certain, you know, you got to keep a certain, you know, I mean, everybody's different the way they monitor their kids academically. You know, my son, you know, in my house, you know, you have to keep a high GPA and, you know, of course, committed to a school like Bucknell, you have to, obviously. So, you know, to me, that's very important too. So if you're playing 5,000 sports, I mean, I'm obviously exaggerating, you know, I think it's a little hard too from an academic standpoint, seriously.
And the other guy that I really appreciate how he advocates for single sport specialization is Peter Baum. He won a Wharton at Colgate. He's been one of the best professional lacrosse players since finishing his college career. And I think that, you know, he's a guy who, you know, has always had a lot of success in individual sports as well, right? So, like, he plays tennis. I'm pretty sure he plays golf as well. You know, and when he talks about lacrosse, he was just like, I'm a non-hotbed kid. I grew up in Portland. Like, I need to devote all of my energy and attention on becoming a better lacrosse player because I was at a disadvantage, and I didn't start playing as young as a lot of other kids and all that sort of stuff. So my argument is similar to yours in the sense that it's not about people who argue for sports specialization are not doing so against multi-sport participation. They're trying to say that I think this is the best situation for me or, you know, my son, my daughter, whatever. And I think that it's there's an imbalance in how loud the advocacy is for each. And I appreciate you stating your opinion that,
I think
that. focusing on lacrosse was good.
I think, yeah, no, I mean, because the thing is, like I said, if look, you gotta, it's a cliche thing, but it's a very true thing. A boy or girl has to have fun. Sports are supposed to be fun. You know, now, you know, you're in high school, you're playing high level, no matter what sport it is, and you're getting recruited, or maybe you are committed somewhere ready for a sport. All right, it starts to become a little bit of a job, and that's a reality, because, you know, I don't believe in, and I think, you know, this is part of the reason my wife and I, you know, I are married as long as we are, we have similar values in the sense of, you know, I don't think you can put a bed of roses under your kid. I think, you know, life is about failure, you know, and I've always told my son, I mean, you know, sometimes you're the hammer, sometimes you're the nail. I mean, your goal is to be the hammer more than the nail, but, you know, if you're the nail, learn from it, you know, learn, you know, and we've all had, you know, failures in our lives, all of us. And you know, we all want perfection for our kids, but the backtrack, you said something about, I think that you said about people that advocate for playing in multiple sports in high school. You said, I don't want to put words in mind, I'm paraphrasing. You said something like, that's their own, they're coming from their own experience.
For
correct?
Sure.
That's what you said, something like that, right? And I agree, because, but now some of those folks need to look at the way lacrosse is now. It's different. The recruiting process, even with this new rule, okay, it's different. The game has grown. People in lacrosse have screamed forever, grow the game, grow the game, grow the game. And I agree, grow the game, that's great. The game has grown, and it's still growing. And the more it grows, the more opportunities there are for kids to play and compete and challenge themselves and to be pushed or pressured or whatever. And that's just reality. It's different than a guy that hypothetically is 52 years old and played lacrosse in high school, you know, umpteen years ago. Ah, you know what? Put your stick down. Go play basketball. Go play, you know, go play football. Dude, real quick story. I remember when Tyler was like in eighth grade, he tried out for the basketball middle school team, right? He's at the tryout. You know, he's like probably the second best kid there, right, in the basketball team. And he had to go to a lacrosse recruiting event for the final day of cuts. He wanted to go to this lacrosse thing, without naming what it was, in Connecticut. He went to the event. The coach said, if you're not here, you know, I'm going to have to, you're not going to make the team, even though we want you on the team. He's like, coach, I know, but I have to go do this try. I want to go do this event, blah, 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 blah. Long story short, he didn't make the team because lacrosse came first to him. You know, it wasn't like that years ago. I think it's a little bit different now. You know, I'm just saying, like, people can throw those things out there, and it's, I mean, you make a good point. It, look at the age of some of the people that are saying these things. It's a different world now. It's a very competitive, ultra-competitive sport now. And not that it never was, and no disrespect to those old players who are the pioneers of the game. I'm not disrespecting that. I have nothing but respect for those men, for sure. But the recruiting process, look, how many, I don't know the stats, I'm not a stat guy, but if you look at from 1980, I don't want to put you in a spot, you might know the answer, you might not. 1980, I don't know how many D1 lacrosse programs there are, and now how many D1s are there in 2017? Like,
yeah, so there are 71 Division I lacrosse programs right now. There were, I don't know about 1980, but like in 2004, there were 55.
I'm just throwing 1980 out there.
Yeah, yeah, well, so I know that in 2004, there were either 55 or 56. And there have been, you know, two programs have been dropped, so that 71 number would be 73 if Butler and Presbyterian are still playing. So, but, you know, in the same period of time, they've gone from, in an average high school class, having been roughly 4,500 to 5,000 graduating seniors in 2005 to over 15,000 this year.
Wow.
And so the high school participation has more than tripled, and the number of Division I opportunities has increased by about a third. So basically a 900% difference. I'm not a stats guy either, so I could be completely wrong about that ratio.
Yeah.
But
you
know what I mean. It's a dramatic difference.
Yeah.
Yes, the top of the pyramid has grown, but not nearly at the rate that it has, that high school participation has.
It's a different world now. I mean, it's just different than years ago. It's you know, especially like with summer ball, you got to play in the summer. That's how you get better. I see with my son's high school team, the kids that play summer travel ball somewhere, I got to tell you, they're the better players. You know, it's not like, you know, back in the day where, hey, let's go play stickball and now, you know, we'll play lacrosse when we can. It's, you know, if you you have a kid who wants to be a player, you got to play. You got to play. It's just that I sound like a crazy dad. I'm sorry.
No, man, that's why you're here. But let's we got to bring this thing in for a landing, and there is a lot more that I want to get to. So we'll have to figure out a time to get you back, and we'll open up the conversation, talk a little bit more about the media side of things.
Yeah, I do this for a living.
I can tell, man.
I talk all day. But
yeah.
Unfortunately, I got a blabbermouth here. I apologize.
No, man.
And here's the funny thing. You know, at a lacrosse game, I say nothing. Like I don't say a word. I root on my kid's team and my kid, and that's it. But I'm not. I don't want people to think, oh, this guy must be a real pain in the ass on the sideline. You know, I'm not. I try to hide. It's about my kid. I come out when there's a microphone and I get the chance to talk. I'm passionate about lacrosse, and on my daily show, I talk about wrestling more than anything, and you know, some other mainstream sports and lacrosse a little bit. So I have a lot to say about lacrosse. So. Scooting it out here.
Yeah, no, it seems cathartic, and I'm sure that we're going to get a lot of folks who are really enjoying it, chopping it up.
Cool.
But I want to get a little bit of wrestling in, because I think that there are some parallels that aren't immediately apparent, and I think that there are some lessons that lacrosse fans can learn from some of this conversation. I want to start by talking about some specifics, and then you know, kind of pull them back a little bit. So, you know, one of the things that I'm so amazed and interested in and impressed by is just wrestlers who have really, really long careers. And so for The Undertaker's retirement to have occurred a couple months ago, you know, I found that storyline to be really fascinating because of the way that it was a cross-section of, you know, every aspect of the sport. And it, you know, so coming away from WrestleMania and everything there, I'm just interested in what your opinion is on, you know, guys who have really long careers, and then, you know, how you transition into the second phase of your career, which is something that obviously you can speak to as well.
Okay, a couple of things. First of all, The Undertaker is one of the greatest of all time, and I've wrestled Taker. I know him, and he's a better person than he is a better wrestler. I mean, he's just a great guy. So nothing. I wish nothing but for the best for that guy. He deserves anything good he gets. He's been in a good position too, which he's earned, where he was not wrestling a full-time schedule. So a lot of these big wrestlers that you see maybe on a WrestleMania that, oh my God, I remember this guy when I was in college. Oh man, I remember this guy back in the day. Yeah. You got to realize when The Rock comes back, or whatever, Steve Austin or Shawn Michaels, or and these guys are all amazing household names, great, great wrestlers for many years, great performers. But you got to say, these guys are not on a full-time schedule. So when you're not on a full-time, and they're not on a full-time schedule for a lot of years, so your body gets a long time to just rest and recoup. And then when you get a chance to come back and maybe have one big highlight match, you know, to be frank, the physicality of the match, you kind of can control that a little bit, you know, and there's a respect for you from the younger wrestler. So that helps with that longevity thing, just to be honest. Not, I'm pulling back the curtain a little bit, but I'm just, you know, people can't think that Taker, he'll be the first to tell you. It's not like he hasn't been on a full-time schedule in probably 7 years, 8 years, and because he physically can't. You know, this business, dude, I'm telling you, you know, it's a business, it's a sport, whatever people want to call it. Look, it's a violent game, okay? And when I say violent, I mean violent to the body as we grow older. I mean, you know, my body's shot, you know, so, you know, and I mean, I'm arthritic. I you know, I try to still train. I can't train like I used to. I got, you know, I have pinched nerves in different parts of my body. I numbness in the leg, you know, and this is all from years of pounding my body, you know, because there is no off season. Okay. For none of the guys and girls, there's no off season, and you make money when you wrestle. See, like I said earlier in this conversation. So it's, you know, you have to keep working and competing, and you're gone all the time. You know, I mean, you know, I when Tyler was little, I wasn't home. I was on the road. I was gone. But you got to make your money while you're young. Because it's a young man's industry or young woman's industry, you know. So that's the other thing. Now, I was fortunate to segue into the broadcast booth, and thanks to Vince McMahon and a guy named Kevin Dunn, who is the senior executive vice president, a Baltimore guy, by the way. he and the Vince McMahon saw something in me as a color commentator. I didn't want to do it. And now I live, now there's TV studios in Stamford, Connecticut, which is only about, you know, an hour from where I live on Long Island. So they're like, listen, you we're going to train you at this. You need to get in the studio and practice, and we're going to teach you how to be a color commentator. You got to get the gab. You have the insight. You have the expertise, yada, yada, yada. The wrestling part was easy. I could talk about what guys do in the ring and break down or what guys are going to do and be entertaining about it and also be insightful with no problem. But the broadcasting, I had no clue. So they put me with a couple of guys to teach me, and they groomed me. I didn't want to, but my wife said, listen, you're getting a chance to have a second career here because you're getting injuries, you're banged up. I just tore my bicep, and I was going to be out for like, I don't know, 6 weeks, whatever the heck it was. And Vince McMahon said, you need to think about, you have a young child at home, you need to think about your future, and you have a future in this broadcasting thing. And instead of giving them pushback a lot, I said, okay, we'll give it a shot. And it worked for me. So I was fortunate to get the opportunity to segue from the ring into the broadcast booth. A lot of guys, unfortunately, and girls, once their WWE run ends, that's why I say it's a violent business. It's a vicious business because it's really tough from a financial standpoint to make the money you were making when you were in WWE. Once you leave WWE, it's very difficult unless you get a deal in Japan wrestling there, because you could make a lot of money there, or, you know, you're working for enough of the smaller independent companies that maybe, you know, you could do well, but you know, it's you're an independent contractor. You try to make as much money as you can and just keep grinding and grinding and grinding and working and save your money. That's the veterans told me when I was young, and I listened. Just save your money and just keep, you know, because it goes quick. It's so different than an NFL guy or Major League Baseball player or a guy in the NHL, an NBA basketball player. You know, it's a different type of contract. It's a different type of deal, and it's different money. You know, there's only, you know, WWE right now, there's probably, out of all the talent, all of the whole roster between SmackDown and Raw and NXT, they probably have, maybe 5-6 guys making 7 figures a year. Seriously. You know, and these are people that are gone all the time. So you got 5-6 guys making over $1 million a year. You know, and just imagine equating that to sports, like, you know, mainstream sports. You know what I mean? Like, you know, A backup offensive tackle is probably making, you know, $800,000 a year. You know what I mean? I mean, I'm just throwing numbers out there. But
no, it's incredibly fascinating. And you touched on two things that I want to dive a little deeper on. I'm just going to lay them both out there, and you can take them as you will. So the first is the issue of, you know, the violence and the sustained injuries that you, or the injuries that you sustain over the course of your career, and particularly focused on head trauma, head, you know, brain injuries, and the way in which every sport has uniquely had to attack that issue and problem as it's emerged. So I'm interested, you know, I'm interested in both your perspective on how wrestling has handled it and how lacrosse has handled it from your perspective. And then the second element is the emergence of women in wrestling and the way that that has been an opportunity, a challenge, and everything in between for all of these wrestling operators. And I'm particularly interested in that because I think lacrosse is in a position where for so long the two entities were viewed as different sports and their rules are so different, but it's a little bit of an everything that rises must converge thing going on. And I think that you're hearing the trumpet a little bit louder, which is collectively, men's and women's lacrosse will forge ahead better than if they try to do so independently and oftentimes at odds with each other. So those two things, injuries, specifically head injuries, and the emergence of women in wrestling and the parallels that both of those have with lacrosse.
Well, first off, it's almost a natural segue there when you speak of head injuries in wrestling and or lacrosse or the correlation, and then you're speaking of women's lacrosse. I mean, when I know these girls are wearing like half helmets now, whatever. When are these girls going to wear real helmets? I mean, this is crazy. I mean, you know, I mean, really, I mean, I've heard of kids here, you know, on the island, girls that I know of, to my wife or people we know, getting concussions. So a girl takes a shot, stick hits a girl in the head, boom, she's got a concussion. I mean, I just think that right there should just be right out of the box. I mean, these girls got to wear helmets, just straight up. I know they don't, not as physical as the boys game and not hitting as much. I got it, but you know, you got to wear a helmet just for a stick hitting a girl in the head. You know,
let me play devil's advocate here for 1 second. Just when you look at the evolution from rugby to NFL football and you consider what putting a helmet on a football player did for his ability to enact violence on someone else. Do you wonder if the NFL would be as equally good a product as it is now in North America because of all the things that surround it and make it popular, but without a lot of the danger associated with it if they were not wearing a hard shell helmet? And I only say that to say, while the stick and ball is an element that doesn't exist in rugby in the same way, it will change the game in a way that will make women's lacrosse more violent, that could theoretically have more injurious long-term effects. Just wanted to throw that out
there. I got to say, Terry, I don't know if I agree with that. Just my opinion. I'm not talking about hitting. I understand what you're saying, that these girls are wearing, you're kind of saying if these girls are wearing helmets, they might go around and start, nailing each other. I don't think that'd be the case. I'm talking about sticks hitting girls in the head. That's what I'm talking about. Look, I mean, first of all, as far as concussion goes, like with football and lacrosse, male, female, whatever, look, the bottom line is I don't care what kind of football helmet you're wearing, what kind of lacrosse helmet you're wearing, the reason why there's all these concussions and why it's changed so much is, and why it's great that there's this awareness of it, which is awesome, and it's in wrestling. I'll get to that in a second per your question. It's because the things I said a lot in this interview, about my son as a kid and all these kids, that the training has evolved, the nutrition has evolved, the equipment can't keep up with the physicality, the speed, the size that athletes bring today. It just can't happen. Unfortunately, it just can't happen. It just can't. These guys are just, you watch, just imagine real quick. Right? I was a huge Jack Lambert fan, right? You remember Jack Lambert? I know you're younger than me, but from the Pittsburgh Steelers, right?
Oh,
one of
yeah,
the greatest
big time.
Linebackers of all time. Yeah. He was a stud, just a monster, right? I wonder if a guy like Jack Lambert or Dick Butkus, if they were playing in the NFL today, do you know how much faster the game is now than when those guys played? Crazy.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's huge.
It's huge. I mean, Ray Lewis, one of the greatest linebackers of all time. I mean, just imagine him running a 40-yard dash against Ray Nitschke from the Green Bay Packers back in the day. He would smoke Nitschke. And Ray is considered, he's retired now, but imagine these younger guys. My point is, the training, the evolution, the psychology behind training. My kid works out all the time. I lived in a weight room as a kid. I don't even know how my son trains. His trainer, the stuff they do, the techniques they do, it's so far advanced from what I know. I'm a dinosaur compared to my generation for training is a dinosaur compared to the athletes today. And that's, I think, why the concussions happen. And in wrestling, a little bit of a different deal. It can be controlled. But me personally, I've had 7 concussions, unfortunately, in my life. Okay? A few of them were playing football, and 4 of them were as a pro wrestler. And, and I've been hit with, I've been hit with steel chairs, but I never got a concussion from a steel chair. I usually got a concussion doing it myself, like in the ring, getting hit from someone and over-rotating my body when I fall. There's a certain way we fall without getting too detailed. And it was my own fault. Or getting hit with a forearm from a guy who come off the ropes and just knock your block off. I mean, and I got a concussion, So the WWE today, like the way they are with concussion protocol, from what I know and understand, even I don't work there anymore, but I know enough people that work there behind the scenes and wrestlers or just trainers. They are there. It's like an NFL team. I mean, it's like an NBA team. I mean, they have top-notch trainers, top-notch physicians and stuff like that, and really make sure the guys and girls are safe. And I'll tell you a real quick story. I don't remember which WrestleMania it was. It was at the Houston Astrodome, and I was in the opening match in a 3-on-3 match, a 6-man match. I got a concussion early in the match, one of my worst concussions of all time, that I've ever had. And it was my own fault. I got hit with a clothesline. Remember the Godfather? Remember him? The whole train? Remember him?
Oh, yeah.
The whole train?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. When he was in a group called the Right to Censor, that was the name of the team. This guy's 6'6", about 320 pounds. He hits with a clothesline, and, it was my own fault. I over-rotated when I hit the mat, and I banged the back of my head really hard, and I was out of it. And I was able to function, and there's even video online of it, and you could see that I'm hitting the ropes. I'm almost falling through the ropes. And thank God my partners helped me through the match. And I go backstage right after WrestleMania at the Astrodome and just went to the trainer's room. And I'm vomiting for, a few minutes. And I knew I had a full-blown bad concussion. I wanted to wrestle the next night on Raw. Now, I'm going back about 10 years. And the doctor's there. This is 10 years ago. Vince himself, you are not wrestling for at least another week. Forget about wrestling tomorrow night on Raw. You were shutting down. So I have to defend the WWE in that regard and pro wrestling in that regard, especially with Vince. He's all about safety, Vince McMahon, for the talent. I got to tell you that straight up. And you know, they're putting millions of dollars into their training and protecting their performers. So now, as far as females in pro wrestling, I mean, geez, it's just great. It's awesome. I mean, it's so nice to see, you know, females not just being looked at as TNA. You know, they're just that they're athletes. These girls are legitimate pro wrestlers. They're legitimate performers. They're legitimate athletes. And WWE, as the standard bearer for the business, as the hood ornament for the wrestling industry, are treating them the right way and treating the way they should be. I've been a part, unfortunately, of many as a commentator, you know, bra and panties matches and stuff like this, this trite, you know, horrible stuff, you know, that guys in a bar might dig, but it was embarrassing. It was like horrible, you know, and the business has changed for females, which is a nice thing. And because it's well-deserved, and some of these females, they're main event in WWE events. I mean, these girls are legit. So, you know, I think I answered the...
Yeah, I think you got. I think you got both of them. I think that, yeah. I mean, there's so much about the future of lacrosse that is TBD, and I think that, you know, WWE and professional wrestling as a whole is oftentimes, and this is kind of, you know, the place that I wanted to end on. Over the course of, say, I don't know if the, you know, kind of wrestling historians view us, you know, view this time to be the third or fourth or fifth era of the WWE and this iteration of the organization. But, you know, realizing that it's gone through multiple points of evolution, I think we're reaching an all-time high of mainstream acceptance and, you know, for example, like in the run-up to WrestleMania, there was a lot of coverage on SportsCenter, and I think that would have been difficult to imagine, you know, even at previous heights of popularity, whether it be, you know, The Rock or the Hulk Hogan
Absolutely.
Days and everything else. And so, you know, I think that the corollary to that is there's a lot of positive lessons that we can take from this, both from a sport and an industry standpoint. And so, you know, the last thing that I just wanted to pick your brain about is how do you see the mainstreamification of professional wrestling as a sport impacting professional wrestling?
Impacting mainstream sport, impacting wrestling, means sports entertainment.
Yeah, like is WWE and professional wrestling as a whole changing in response and in reaction to this recognition from mainstream sports media in a way that it hadn't previously?
No, I think that the sports entertainment and the WWE wrestling industry is changing sport, to your point. That what you said earlier, because you get major, you know, worldwide broadcast companies like ESPN or CBS Sports Network, and, you know, covering. Well, I was talking about the cross with that part. I mean, I wanted to get to that in a second. Back to wrestling, you get verticals, online verticals, on websites like CBS Sports Network, Fox Sports Network, ESPN TV, and their verticals online. They all have, if you go to like CBS Sports, not just because not to be a homer, not because I work for them, but if you go to CBS, CBSSports.com, whatever the heck the website is, there's on their vertical, there's a WWE tab. If you go to Fox Sports, there's a WWE tab. ESPN has a WWE vertical. The point is, these are mainstream monster broadcast companies, corporations, that are covering the wrestling industry, the WWE, mostly WWE, on a daily basis. Look, I do a daily show covering wrestling, and I am under contract to CBS. So, you know, like, my point is, I think WWE has changed the game and showed that, you know, there are these big venues all over the United States that are fighting for who wants to cover WrestleMania. Have it in my venue, you know. Because it picks up the economy in the town, just like when the Super Bowl comes to town. That's what WrestleMania has become, right or wrong.
I was in New Orleans for WrestleMania, Taker's first loss in WrestleMania. It was one of the most global sporting experiences I've ever been a part of. The international fans that flew in for that event was jaw-dropping to me. It was one of the coolest experiences I've ever seen.
There you go, man. I'm telling you. So it's like, this is, and this, I got to be honest, and again, I don't work for the guy anymore, but I worked for him for a decade, and this is Vince McMahon's vision. Guys like Triple H work under him and his daughter, Stephanie. These people had this vision a long time ago. Look, you understand something. WWE is a publicly traded company, okay? So this is not like, I remember, you know, just, I remember hearing Vince, you know, in meetings or you know, talking about, we need to get away, this is years ago, we need to get away and never go back to the smoke-filled arena with the spotlight over the ring. All right, in this corner, weighing 260 pounds from Canarsie, Brooklyn. You know, that, like that whole thing to Vince, that makes him cringe. You know, like to him, he feels like that's a black eye on our industry and our business. So he's had a bigger vision for many, many years. You know, so this is a guy who's been plugging at this. This is a, you know, third generation guy from his father to his grandfather. You know, they've all were promoters, you know, so it took a lot of years and millions of dollars for Vince to get to this point. You know, real quick, WrestleMania 1, I've heard Vince say the story to my ears. I've heard it. You know, Vince and Linda McMahon, his wife, you know, they put everything they had financially on WrestleMania 1. It was do or die. And they didn't have a ton like people thought. And it worked, and it just built and built and built and built and built. So this is not a guy who was like blowing a silver spoon in his mouth, you know? So I have a lot of respect for Vince. Obviously you can hear that. I don't work for him anymore. But I've learned a lot from him, and he's given me a lot and, you know, a lot of opportunities. And so I wouldn't have the job I have now as a streaming video and radio host if it wasn't for him, you know, telling me, hey dude, become a broadcaster and we're going to teach you. So I'm obviously grateful.
Yeah, well, and certainly you got the gift of gab, so you deserve a little bit of credit there for yourself. I think that the listeners of this podcast will agree with me that we've learned a lot just listening to you. I've really enjoyed this conversation. We could literally go all day. You know, we're an hour and 15 in, and I feel like we're only getting started. But we got it. We got to end this because I just don't know if we can make the file size small enough that iTunes is going to be able to hold it. Too much heat on this podcast.
Like, this is like a three part. It's like a mini series.
An epic.
It's like
all right, Tez.
1, 2, and 3. It's crazy.
We appreciate you kicking off the summertime lacrosse season. The college lacrosse season is behind us, but that doesn't mean that the Inside Lacrosse podcast will slow down, and we appreciate you helping us get this started.
No doubt, man. I appreciate you guys having me on, and it's a great sport. I love the sport, and I just want people to respect it. Obviously, people who listen to this, or parents, or coaches, they respect the game, or former players. And I wish I was a lacrosse player back in my day. So, I mean, I wish I had it in my school, but you know, so one of the best things I get to do is watch my son compete, and I love it, and I love the game. So I appreciate what you guys do.
And for those of you that want to hear more from Taz, 7 to 9 a.m. every morning, right? You go 5 days a week?
Yes, sir.
On CBS Radio.
Yeah. TazShow.com, T-A-Z-S-H-O-W, TazShow.com. Streams live right there every day. Free.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.